Chapter 23. Here perhaps my story ought to stop, for I was happy at last, and have never since, thank heaven, known want. But Gus insists that I should add how I gave up the place in the tape and sealing wax office, and for what reason. That excellent Lady Jane Preston is long gone, and so is Mr. P. off in an apoplexy, and there is no harm now in telling the story. The fact was that Mr. Preston had fallen in love with Mary in a much more serious way than any of us imagined, for I do believe he invited his brother-in-law to Richmond for no other purpose than to pay court to his son's nurse. And one day, as I was coming post-haste to thank him for the place he had procured for me, being directed by Mr. Charles to the crubbery, as he called it, which led down to the river there, sure enough, I found Mr. Preston, on his knees too, on the gravel walk, and before him Mary, holding the little lord. "Dearest creature," says Mr. Preston, "do but listen to me, and I'll make your husband consul at Timbuktu. He shall never know of it, I tell you. He can never know of it. I pledge you my word as a cabinet minister. Oh, don't look at me in that arch way. By heavens, your eyes kill me." Mary, when she saw me, burst out laughing, and ran down the lawn, my lord making a huge crowing to, and holding out his little fat hands. Mr. Preston, who was a heavy man, was slowly getting up, when, catching a sight of me looking as fierce as the crater of Mount Etna, he gave a start back, and lost his footing, and rolled over and over, walloping into the water at the garden's edge. It was not deep, and he came bubbling and snorting out again in as much fright as fury. "You DD ungrateful villain," says he, "what do you stand there laughing for?" "I'm waiting your orders for Timbuktu, sir," says I, and laughed fit to die. And so did my lord Tiptoff and his party, who joined us on the lawn. And Jeems the footman came forward, and helped Mr. Preston out of the water. "Oh, you old sinner," says my lord, as his brother-in-law came up the slope. "Ill that heart of yours be always so susceptible, you romantic, apoplectic, immoral man?" Mr. Preston went away, looking blue with rage, and ill-treated his wife for a whole month afterwards. "At any rate," says my lord, "Titmarsh here has got a place through our friend's unhappy attachment, and Mrs. Titmarsh has only laughed at him, so there is no harm there. It's an ill wind that blows nobody good, you know. Such a wind as that, my lord, with due respect to you, shall never do good to me. I have learned in the past few years what it is to make friends with the mammon of unrighteousness, and that out of such friendship, no good comes in the end to honest men. It shall never be said that Sam Titmarsh got a place because a great man was in love with his wife, and were the situation 10 times as valuable, I should blush every day I entered the office doors in thinking of the base means by which my fortune was made. You have made me free, my lord, and, thank God, I am willing to work. I can easily get a clerkship with the assistance of my friends, and with that and my wife's income, we can manage honestly to face the world." This rather long speech I made with some animation, for, look you, I was not over well pleased that his lordship should think me capable of speculating in any way on my wife's beauty. My lord at first turned red, and looked rather angry, but at last he held out his hand and said, "You are right, Titmarsh, and I am wrong, and let me tell you in confidence that I think you are a very honest fellow. You shan't lose by your honesty, I promise you." Nor did I. For I am at this present moment Lord Tiptoff's steward and right-hand man. And am I not a happy father? And is not my wife loved and respected by all the country? And is not Gus Hoskins my brother-in-law, partner with his excellent father in the leather way, and the delight of all his nephews and nieces for his tricks and fun? As for Mr. Bro, that gentleman's history would fill a volume of itself. Since he vanished from the London world, he has become celebrated on the continent, where he has acted 1,000 parts, and met all sorts of changes of high and low fortune. One thing we may at least admire in the man, and that is, his undaunted courage. And I can't help thinking, as I have said before, that there must be some good in him, seeing the way in which his family are faithful to him. With respect to Roundhand, I had best also speak tenderly. The case of Roundhand v. Tidd is still in the memory of the public, nor can I ever understand how Bill Tidd, so poetic as he was, could ever take on with such a fat, odious, vulgar woman as Mrs. R., who was old enough to be his mother. As soon as we were in prosperity, Mr. and Mrs. Grimes Wapshot made overtures to be reconciled to us, and Mr. Wapshot laid bare to me all the baseness of Mr. Smithers' conduct in the Bro transaction. Smithers had also endeavored to pay his court to me, once when I went down to Somersetshire, but I cut his pretensions short, as I have shown. It was, said Mr. Wapshot, who induced Mrs. Grimes, Mrs. Haggerty she was then, to purchase the West Didlesex shares, receiving, of course, a large bonus for himself. But directly he found that Mrs. Haggerty had fallen into the hands of Mr. Bro, and that he should lose the income he made from the lawsuits with her tenants, and from the management of her landed property, he determined to rescue her from that villain Bro, and came to town for the purpose. He also, added Mr. Wapshot, vented his malignant slander against me, but heaven was pleased to frustrate his base schemes. In the proceedings consequent on Bro's bankruptcy, Mr. Smithers could not appear, for his own share in the transactions of the company would have been most certainly shown up. During his absence from London, I became the husband, the happy husband of your aunt. But though, my dear sir, I have been the means of bringing her to grace, I cannot disguise from you that Mrs. W. has faults which all my pastoral care has not enabled me to eradicate. She is close of her money, sir, very close, nor can I make that charitable use of her property which, as a clergyman, I ought to do, for as he has tied up every shilling of it, and only allows me half a crown a week for pocket money. In temper too, she is very violent. During the first years of our union, I strove with her, yea, I chastised her, but her perseverance, I must confess, got the better of me. I make no more remonstrances, but am as a lamb in her hands, and she leads me whithersoever she pleases. Mr. Wapshot concluded his tale by borrowing half a crown from me. It was at the Somerset Coffee House in the Strand, where he came, in the year 1832, to wait upon me, and I saw him go from thence into the gin shop opposite, and come out of the gin shop half an hour afterwards, reeling across the streets, and perfectly intoxicated. He died next year. When his widow, who called herself Mrs. Haggerty Grimes Wapshot, of Castle Haggerty, said that over the grave of her saint all earthly resentments were forgotten, and proposed to come and live with us, paying us, of course, a handsome remuneration. But this offer my wife and I respectfully declined, and once more she altered her will, which once more as he had made in our favor, called us ungrateful wretches and pampered menials, and left all her property to the Irish Haggertys. But seeing my wife one day in a carriage with Lady Tiptoff, and hearing that we had been at the great ball at Tiptoff Castle, and that I had grown to be a rich man, she changed her mind again, sent for me on her deathbed, and left me the farms of Slopperton and Squashtail, with all her savings for 15 years. Peace be to her soul. For certainly she left me a very pretty property. Though I am no literary man myself, my cousin Michael, who generally, when he is short of coin, comes down and passes a few months with us, says that my memoirs may be of some use to the public, meaning, I suspect, to himself, and if so, I am glad to serve him and them, and hereby take farewell, bidding all gents who peruse this to be cautious of their money, if they have it, to be still more cautious of their friends' money, to remember that great profits imply great risks, and that the great shrewd capitalists of this country would not be content with 4% for their money, if they could securely get more. Above all, I entreat them never to embark in any speculation, of which the conduct is not perfectly clear to them, and of which the agents are not perfectly open and loyal. End of Project Gutenberg Text The Great Agardi Diamond, by Thackeray. GTHGD by Gutenberg Edition.